Well, I don't know how much wisdom, but there's a great deal of experience. Believe me. Right. Well, as you know, I'm a part of the Naples Sangha, member, and I assume I'm a part of all of this. And every Sunday night, I guess it's the same thing here, somebody gives the talk. And we were presented with a list of topics. And there was one that really jumped out at me. And that was, what I wanted to do was to understand a view that was broader than the myopic, one-pointed, selfish view that I had had many years ago. And it all started with the way I lived. I grew up in a wonderful, loving family, and we were very small. It was in Boston, Massachusetts. But whatever they did, that was it. There was nothing outside of our little group. And you know, that was fine. I was very happy with it. No conflicts, no rebellion, you know, so forth. However, later on, I got married, moved to New York, etc., etc. And then, because of Fred, I went up to the Zen Center in Rochester, New York. Buddhism was completely foreign to me, and I just had to find out what was this that my son was getting into. So I went up there, and it was quite austere, very severe, and in order to stay there for a few days, I had to work. So where did I work? In the kitchen. And I was put at a counter, and what I had to do was peel carrots and chop carrots. And I was told, of course this was all in silence, that all you do when you peel the carrots, you peel the carrots. That's it. Nothing else. Well, you know, that wasn't easy, but I was trying to focus on the carrots. And silence. And there was almost, I can't really tell you, there was almost like communication in the silence of everybody working in that kitchen and all being like one. And I spent a few days there, and of course it was, as I say, very severe and austere, you know, Zen-like and so forth. But I did have the opportunity to meet Roshi Kaplow. And because of that meeting, when I got back to New York, I bought his book, Three Pillars of Zen, which was quite a revelation for me, because here was a man who supposedly had everything, you know, success, da-da-da, but there was something missing. And you know, my life was good. There was no complaint. But I started to realize that there is something more. There is something deeper. But, you know, these thoughts sort of came and went. And there wasn't too much after that. Then, 20 years ago or more, I went to a retreat up in Rhinebeck, New York, at the Omega Institute, and it was a Thich Nhat Hanh retreat. And sitting there, and seeing this dear little man come out and start speaking to us, very humble, very quiet, but there was an aura of such peace, such tranquility, that, you know, I mean, for me, I just looked at him in amazement, and then he started to speak. And the thing that I took away from this was he spoke about listening. And all of a sudden, I became aware that I have been listening and hearing, but never really listening. And he really kept talking about this and how when you listen to the person and you really start to have a little understanding, or try to have understanding, a little compassion, a little feeling from where he was coming. And you know, that resonated because I realized that I had listened, I had heard, but I never really listened. And it was such, well, I can't say an awakening, but it was unbelievable that all these years I had gone along and there was so much that I was missing that I hadn't really gotten into. So I went back to New York and, well, sort of sat a little bit, you know, here, but not with any real commitment. And then I came to Florida. And as Andy said, I really started out at this small little sangha at 99 North Street and began to sit a little bit more, read a little bit more, great deal of Thich Nhat Hanh, and then I went to a retreat up in New York. And on that retreat, Anne Hung was there, who is Thich Nhat Hanh's niece. And even though it was, I don't know how I shouldn't say this, even though it was a silent retreat, somehow or other we started to speak, Anne and I. And, you know, I was listening to this woman, and there was no bitterness, nothing about the horrible experiences that she had been through, with absolutely no rancor. Why did this happen to me? I think it was like an inspiration, listening to a person who could have been through so much, and really was accepting and going forth. And at that same retreat, I was ordained as a layperson, and that sort of gave me even more of a commitment. And then when I got back, I started to practice more. And the three jewels became an important part of my life, because I was getting from the Buddha the Dharma, and I had the Sangha in Naples as my support. And then I would sit, but I got the realization that there's more to, I shouldn't say that. For me, there was more to sitting, but what I really had to do was to use these wonderful teachings in my life and to use this practice as a path for me to go on. And of course, I had a teacher. No names. Who was so helpful to guide me along the path that I began to feel that this was the path that I wanted to go on. And you know, I've always said that I find, this is only for me, the practice of Buddhism very simple, because I took, for example, and that's why I brought this here, the five remembrances as my mantra. Now, and this is also true for me, I am of the nature to grow old. Here I am, right? There is no way to escape growing old. I'm of the nature to have ill health. There's no way to escape ill health. I am the nature to die. there is no way to escape death. Or may I paraphrase it and say, there's no way to escape the death of those you love. So you have the experience of death. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. We do know of impermanence, right? That's a very basic teaching. There is no way to be separated from them. I inherit the result of my actions by my body, speech, and mind. And my actions are the ground on which I stand. And I fervently believe that. And I am going to give you, I don't want to go into my whole life, but I'm going to give you a few examples of how this belief, this practice, has been so wonderful and so helpful and such a support for me. My husband had Alzheimer's, and that is a very difficult disease to comprehend. And at the beginning, it was very hard. But then, as I started to think of all the things that I had been taught, from my metta, loving kindness, to give this loving kindness to my husband, compassion. This is all I could offer him, because I realized for all those inappropriate behaviors, he wasn't responsible. He couldn't help it. And it was only through my understanding and my love and my acceptance of the fact that illness maybe comes along with old age or whatever. And as I say, just showing him my love not only helped, I don't know how much it helped him because I don't think he could even realize it, but I can only say that for me, it was such a boon, really, and really helped me to accept and understand and not have this mar the rest of my existence and my friends, my people, my children, not to have this be such a downer on our lives. That's one. The next example is there was a rift in our family. My brother and sister-in-law and their children and my husband and me and I, we were just, you know, like that. We had houses near each other and so forth and so on. And all of a sudden, there was a rift. And of course, how could she do this to me? Such anger. Look at all we've had. She's destroying it. What's the matter with her? And what's the matter with my brother? How could he go along with this? He had lived with me for 7 years. So, you know, I was almost sort of like, anyway, it was really very, very difficult. But it was only what they were doing to me. Only to me. And then the rift was kind of healed. And as I began to practice more and more, I started to realize, now where were they coming from? Why were they acting this way? Why did this happen? And it really, I had to stop thinking of me and stop thinking a little bit about them and what was going on in their lives and what was the cause of this. Believe me, I would have never gone along this kind of thinking if it hadn't been for the teachings that I had received. Now, over the years, we've sort of got along. My brother passed away, and unfortunately, my sister-in-law became very, very ill. But I still went to see her, and there was such forgiveness in my heart because I really felt so sorry for her. And the last time I visited her, I said goodbye. Put my arms around her. And she said to me, Ruth, I love you. And for me, this kind of forgiveness was all that I had learned from my practice. I have such gratitude for the way I, and here I'm a bit too much with the I know, but my life has expanded so. I've been able to care and touch and understand. I can only say it's all because I've been able to use these teachings in my life. I mean, there is so much that I have. For example, and I won't go any too much further with that, but, you know, I try to practice mindful breathing when I meditate, you know, and so forth and so on. A few years ago, I had a medical procedure. And as I'm stretched out there, the physician says to me, now, you know, this is going to hurt, but I just want you to know I'll do my best. When I heard those words, you know what I did? I started to practice my mindful breathing. And it was, oops, I lost something. Fine. Thank you. And as the doctor said to me, you didn't even move. You didn't even flinch. And I said to him, I said, I'm very grateful because I'm a Buddhist. And I'm only practicing what I've been taught. And it's now on the flip side, on this, I love bridge, and I'm a bridge player. And as I told you before, I was first taught that when I cut the carrots, I only cut the carrots. When I play bridge, I only play bridge. And I can concentrate, and it really has helped my game. What can I say? I am really filled with such gratitude and such thankfulness. And as the years have progressed, fortunately for me, I've been able to go to more retreats. I've been able to be a part of more intensive. And even though I may not remember as much as I once did, still, I am able to grow. And my life, as old as I am, is full. I keep expanding. I meet more people. I'm more in touch with them. I can open up with them. It's as though into being, but it really works for me. I only, you know, in our intensives, one was on the Diamond Sutra, and I know there's a lot to it, but you know what I took away from it? That when you help people, or when you try to be of assistance, you shouldn't think of the merit or what this is. You just do it. And the reward that I have gotten in here from being able to do this, words can't really tell you this at all. So that for me, it's just gratitude and gratitude and thankfulness. Oh, and then we did another one, Shantideva. And at that time, I remember he said, to show your appreciation, you come with jewels and diamonds and pearls, etc. I don't have jewels, I don't have diamonds, I don't have pearls. But what I do have is deep appreciation, deep gratitude, and deep love. It's as though my heart keeps getting bigger and bigger. Really. And so how can I be able to express my gratitude to, again, the Buddha, the Sangha, the Dharma, the teachings, and to my teacher who has helped me so along the way? All I can think of is I can only try to support the center with whatever generosity I have so that other human beings will be able to reap the rewards, the joy and happiness in life that I have at almost 96 years.
I'm a mother of three, and I have a question. As a mother, we want to raise our kids the best way we can, mm-hmm. And help them just follow the path of truth. Do you have any insights or recommendations on how to raise children in this world as mindful children?
Well, for me, first of all, I had preconceived notions as how these children should be. They should grow up with my point of view, my way, that whole bit. And then all of a sudden, I had children, frankly, who had a whole different way of doing things. And I had to, first of all, I had to investigate. That's why I went up to his Zen. Seriously. I mean, that's why I went up to the Zen Center. I have another son who, in his own way, went off on his own path. But, and I went and got involved in his thing too. But every time I went, I had to realize that there was another way but my way. And I didn't say anything, but I think that as we have children, and if we can only learn to let go and not to be so attached to our own way of thinking, of doing things, I think that's very helpful. At least it was for me. At times it was very difficult. Believe me, I was very fearful. But I had to have confidence in what they were doing was the only way that they could live. And who am I to say that mine is the only way? Or maybe I was just lucky. But really, I think that as parents, or for me as a parent, I have had to try, and it's really trying because it isn't easy, but to let go. Because maybe the plans that I had weren't right for them. And I have to give them that freedom. Not easy, believe me. But look.
Yeah.
wonderful good fortune of watching Ruth with her great-grandson, Leo. And what strikes me, you know how a young child, 14 months, is so fresh and everything in life is so new. You know, and then we become conditioned and we have all our important things to do. But when I watch Ruth with Leo, Ruth is so fresh too. The two of them have that purity and that freshness that it's like, no, we don't have to lose that. You know, look at Ruth at 96 years old and how fresh she is with life, with everybody. I mean, it's a really beautiful
consistence to practices lately. Whether it's sitting practice or mindfulness practice in general, you know, I was wondering if you could share about your experience with dealing with hindrances and resistance.
Oh, very easily. You know, this doesn't happen overnight. And at the beginning, to be able to sit and to be able to digest all these new ideas, they were new thoughts, new ways, and they were foreign. But for me, it was slow, one step at a time. And once I stopped thinking about how difficult it was for me and how I couldn't do this, like, you know, just to accept the way it was. And whatever I was doing was more than I had ever done before. So that was some kind of progress. And then once I tried to employ whatever teachings in my daily life, it was easier. Because sitting for me was not the panacea, if I can use that word, that I thought it would be, very honestly. And I think the more that we learn about accepting, and accepting us. You know, the thing that I love best about the Metta is loving yourself. And I think that if you can stop thinking about, well, what is this I'm doing? I'm doing it. And that's okay. At least for me, I think that's very helpful. And look at all these wonderful teachers that we read about who spent hundreds of years, well, not many, but many, many years trying to get to Nirvana or whatever. Look where you are. You know, you have a long way to go. So don't have such expectations for yourself. You know? It's great what you're doing, and that's good enough. And one step, another step, you know. I don't know if that's helpful, but love yourself.
I would just like to thank Ruth again for sharing her practice and giving this talk. She gave this talk down in Naples a few weeks ago. And it was very, very moving, and it reminded me of how important it is that it is about sitting on the cushion and practicing on the cushion, but it's also really about transforming our lives. And that was a wonderful reminder that that's really what it's about. So thank you, Ruth.
And so let me just, everything has been said. So if I don't want to upstage one who's wiser than me. But again, Ruth has it's interesting. I mean, the ground with her was always good. There was always a goodness in her and a capacity. People always liked her, and people always felt comfortable with her. And so really for her, the Dharma, her practice, her embrace of the practice, has really just, in a certain sense, all those, the few rough edges that she might have had, really got softened. And the inherent capacities that were there just got brighter. They shined even brighter. And just two things that come to mind. First, you know, many people often will say to me, oh, I wish, like, you know, I wish I found Dharma or these practices years ago, you know, it's, you know, so late in my life, or I don't know, I've done so much of this and that. And again, the fact that Ruth didn't start really practicing until she was 80 should be a reminder for all of us, no matter where we are in life or what we've done in life, the capacity for transformation is always available. And again, sort of what Angie said, that even as our bodies may age, the mind is not subject to aging. And so I think Ruth is a wonderful example that even in 96 years, and as her body is sort of shrinking, her mind is expanding. And like Angie said, it's amazing that at 96 she's still alive and fresh and growing and interested. And again, that should be an inspiration to all of us not to get caught. And then the other interesting thing that just struck me was when I went in 1994, when I was in Plum Village to receive the transmission from the teacher from Thich Nhat Hanh. At the end of the ceremony, he sort of addresses you individually. I mean, the one thing I remember him saying that was kind of interesting at the time was usually he kind of says to you, it is your job now to transmit the teachings, to future generations, etc. But the other interesting thing he just said to me, because there were a couple of other people receiving transmission then, was, and it's also your job to, probably means your job, but anyhow, to transmit it to your bloodline. And at that time, 1994, I had my son and my daughter sort of as my seconds. They were 14 or 15 at the time. So somehow I thought that's what he meant. But I didn't realize that that bloodline goes up as well. Now I understand the injunction more clearly. So.